Hello and welcome along to the Anxiety Specialist podcast. I'm your host, Michael Burrows.
And I'm Becky Burrows.
If you've been struggling with anxiety or know someone who has been, then this podcast is for you.
Today, we're going to be covering some more tips, strategies, and insights so you can get the anxiety-free life you deserve.
Ready? Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Anxiety Specialist Podcast. I am your host, Becky, and this is Michael. We are doing a podcast today on what it would be like if you could talk to your future self who is struggling with mental health with all the experience you've had in the past. That's something that I did through writing some letters, and I'm going to talk about how that helped me actually to prevent my mental health going down. That's what we're going to be doing today. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Let's jump into it. So time travel, that's what we're talking about today.
Mm.
Fan of time travel?
Sure. Fan of Back to the Future?
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
But that's just because it was a cool movie. It could have been about anything.
Does he meet himself in that movie? Does he bump into himself, or does he actively try to avoid him?
In the future.
Yeah, he meets his future self.
But they can't make contact. That'd be bad. Yeah.
In this podcast, we're actually talking about time travel and the idea of being able to talk to your future self about your mental health. So I know in the past, when I've gone through stuff, looking back, being in a completely different headspace, there's certain things that I would have liked to be able to say to myself while I was going through those mental health struggles. It's been quite obvious, actually, the big difference in mental headspace between the different conditions. Like, can you think of some specifics around that? Difference between, like, me when I was depressed versus not depressed? Did you notice quite a big difference?
Well, sure. And how you were acting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, depression always comes with that lethargy where things are slower, it's harder to think. And of course, your thoughts were far more negative, especially about yourself.
Yeah, depression acts like a negative filter. It's like everything that comes through, the negative comes through and it blocks out majority of the positive stuff. So you see yourself more negatively, you see your situations as more negative. It's definitely something that when you shift out of that, when you move away from the depression mindset, it's sometimes even hard to think back on like how I saw the world that way because it's so different. It does feel like a different reality.
Yes.
Being depressed versus not.
It's sometimes a little bit akin to when you think back into childhood about how you thought. And it's like, oh, well, I thought quite differently then.
Or as a teenager.
Yes.
Yeah. So today what we're talking about is about being able to do that. And actually recently I did that. I was able to preemptively talk to myself in a mental health difficulty by writing some letters. I wrote some letters to myself, a number of them, just in case that those things popped up again. Yeah. And the context for that is we had another child, which you might not have known about. We haven't been hugely open about it until it really happened for a range of reasons. But yeah, so we've had number two recently.
So you wrote some letters to yourself. The context of having the second child. Why don't you tell us a bit about the reasons why you would do that for the second child?
Yeah, well, the reason for me was that if you know much of my context, I had a really negative experience with our first child, not with the birth itself, like a lot of people will have a traumatic birth, but for me, it was more to do with what happened afterwards. I had a range of things happen, especially to do with my mental health, actually, and misunderstandings about my mental health that led to me getting traumatized. And because of that, I struggled with a range of things. I went up, I was sort of hyperactivated. I was in trauma. So thinking that things were happening that weren't happening, that sort of stuff. So this time around, I really wanted to be able to help prevent that and support myself. And so in a wider context, I've created a mental health plan, but specifically as part of that plan is I wrote myself a series of letters to help deal with that. And I'm going to go over what I covered in them and why I did that and the possible struggles that came up from writing those letters, actually, and especially what I thought I needed to hear from what I've been through before.
So tell us a bit about what those covered and why.
Yeah, so the first one I went through was I wrote a letter for depression, and I might actually just read that to you guys because think will be the easiest way to share, to kind of speak into that would be to actually just read it out. Only letter I'm going to read out to you guys because it's more general rather than specific to my situation, but I thought this might be helpful if you're thinking about maybe writing a letter to yourself about if you have had depression before and you're a bit concerned that you might have it again, if something's coming up that you think might trigger it, and this is something that you could think about doing for yourself, even if it wasn't around a birth, it was just in general. So I said to myself this, hey Becky from the past writing, so you're feeling depressed, that really sucks. And we've been there before and we've come out of it. Trust you can again. You probably don't feel like doing much at all. That makes sense. You might just think it's tiredness and you need to sleep and chill out in front of TV. I'm okay with you trying that, but if after sleeping or watching a nice movie you still feel lethargic, it's time to go with the depression plan. And as part of that side note, outside of the letter, we have a maternity health plan which covers a whole lot of things to do, just so that context of what that's about. Back to the letter. If you do nothing else, go walk in the sea. It will be cold and probably not very nice, but it will help you to start to rise out of this thing. And that's ultimately what will feel good. Now, food was a really big part of it last time, so check out that. I made lots of food in advance to help you with this, so use it. Do things you used to enjoy, even if they don't feel good right now. Puzzles, anime, going to the dog park, spending time with Katie, the joy will come back for them. Be kind to yourself. If you're feeling down, it's very likely, I'm saying almost definitely, that you're being mean to yourself. It's easy to slip into that habit, especially if external people who you are actually angry with are too big and intimidating to actually feel anger towards. So release that anger rather than self-directing. Punch a pillow, throw an egg at the fence, drive in the car and scream, throw your arms and legs around. Get it out and be kinder. You might see yourself right now as being a horrible person, but I'm going to argue heatedly that you are not. You are a beautiful and powerful and insightful person. You are a great mum. You are incredibly good at mothering and you are worthy of being a mum. You have great mothering instincts. You are not perfect and that is not what your kids need. They need your love and attention and you do that really well. Okay, is it COVID stuff that's getting you down? That's a hard one because it's so big. However, remember how despite how big it is, you've been able to grow and thrive despite it. No matter what is happening, I know you still can and will. Hang in there. Use gratitude to find ways you are still thriving and surviving. Remember, this will pass. Follow the plan. The strategy we have written down will work. You know what to do. See you on the other side. It gets better than this. Love, past Becky. So that's what I covered in the letter. It was interesting because talking about depression, it's something that I've found hard to relate to in the past.
Yes. I mean, depression's not something that I've extensively experienced, so it's not something that I can draw on as much of that as I can with multiple different kinds of anxiety.
Yeah, I find also your outlook on life, the way you see life, lends itself to a lot more positivity, I think.
Yes. I can generally envision a future that's going to be positive. And hopelessness, to some extent, is going to be a mental requirement of feeling depressed, getting that hibernatory downward spiral that you get physically as the body tries to conserve energy to get through that negative future that you can do nothing about, aka hopelessness.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think this is where it's quite good to write to yourself as having been depressed before, because someone who has never experienced it doesn't necessarily always know what you need to hear. And Michael didn't do this. He was really good at not doing this. But sometimes you can get people positivity sprinkler in your face, sort of unhelpful positivity.
Or trying to minimize the depressed mood.
Yeah. It's like sunshine, rainbows, everything is great. Stop being depressed. And it's just like, as a depressed person, that's just really unhelpful. So
it's invalidating your emotions.
Yeah, exactly.
That you're feeling your current body state.
Yeah. Mm. And so I think these are the things I needed to hear for me. Firstly, it sucks, and that's understandable. There's this great person who does this comic strip, Hyperbole and a Half, and she writes about how the positivity sprinkler in the face, and about how what she really wanted to hear is just someone being like, it's kind of like your fish are dead, and it's like, oh, it's sad that your fish are dead. Not someone be like, should we try and find your fish? And it's like, they're dead. But anyway, the whole thing about that is that acknowledgement. I think it's just kind of sitting for a moment and that it sucks, that it's hard right now. And having empathy, I guess, for that. And having been there before, I can. That's what I really wanted to start with myself. I think also sometimes, especially in the early stages, the difference, if you're a new mum, the difference between really tired and sort of stressed out versus depressed can be a bit hard to differentiate. And that's where, like I did say in my letter to myself, I'm okay with you going and taking some time to have some sleep, to watch a nice movie. And if that perks you back up again, great. Because when you're down, sometimes those are the things you think you want. But the difference with when you're down is that you do those things, you have the sleep, you watch something, and then you don't feel any better. You still feel meh. And if that happens, that's where you really want to get into a plan, which I find with depression is often counter what you actually feel like doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the case with most disorders, especially with depressed mood. But psychological treatment is often counterintuitive because it's the opposite of what we'd do if it was a physical problem. So depressed mood is a perfect example, right? Mm. Depressed mood, you feel really tired, really lethargic, like you've got no energy left, you got no spoons. And if that was physical, then resting would be exactly what you want to do. You want to rest up, gain that energy back, do some sleeping, just watch some TV, restore that, and then come back out with energy full out of the gate. But when it's actually caused by your body conserving that energy, hibernating down, depressing the central nervous system, then following that just deepens the hibernation, deepens the depressed mood. You feel more down, more lethargic. It doesn't improve it, whereas doing the opposite can.
That's interesting you brought up the hibernation side of things. Mm. And I kind of want to just quickly touch on that because I don't know if many people have actually made that connection. It's something that we realized was the connection between when you're pressing, it's like you're going into hibernation. It's because of that hopelessness. Because let's think about back in the day, before the complexities of the modern world, hopelessness would probably be around your basic needs. So things like food. In winter, you would slow down and hibernate because you don't have quite as much food, that sort of thing. But in the modern world, the hopelessness is not to do with our food source. It's not necessarily to do with conserving energy till the winter's over. It's about things often beyond our control sometimes. So those behaviors actually are not helpful. So what I found is if I do those things like sleeping and watching TV and I find that it doesn't change things, then it's the doing the opposite. And for me, one of the things I have been doing recently, which has been, is the opposite of depression. It's totally the opposite of depression. Going and walking in the cold sea. I don't know much opposites. And I've heard a bit about, which would be really interesting to dig into in the future, about how cold water can actually help with depressed mood. But it just really shocks you out of the lethargy. And also that movement, moving your body is another thing. The last thing you kind of want to slow down and not do anything, but getting out and getting moving. And that's something I've been doing regularly recently. So it's less of a push for me to go straight into the sea. But for a depressed person, that might be quite a mess.
Yeah, if they don't regularly go in the sea and you're like, go in the sea, they're like, what?
Like, that's completely unreasonable for a depressed person. But the context of that is leading up to the birth, I had to go walk in the sea twice a week to keep my mobility up because I had real problems with my lower back and back issues. And the combination of the cold water, the movement in the sea and the slope and walking while supported while pregnant helped keep me from being in a wheelchair. That's the context. I was already doing that. So it's just doing something I was already doing. But for other people, doing a form of exercise that you used to do, like walking, going for a walk with friends, taking a dog for a walk.
Basically, you want to do something either physically active or socially active.
Yeah, meeting with a friend, giving someone a call, that sort of stuff.
Either of those are the opposite of hibernating.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the thing. And those things are outlined and were outlined in my maternity health plan as well to do those things. I also like food for me is something I need to check on because when I'm not eating the right food, then I do notice that my mood can depress, especially gluten for some reason with me. Gluten seems to depress me. And I made a whole lot of food beforehand. So you won't necessarily have a whole lot of food on hand to feed your depressed self. But I'd done that before giving birth just so that I had that. So I was just kind of reminding myself of that. And then I talked about in the letter about doing things I enjoy. So that's a big part of when you're depressed is making sure that you continue to do the things that used to bring you joy, even though they don't bring you joy now, because as you're doing them, it helps return that joy.
Yes. Yeah. Even though you might not feel it at first because all the pleasure can go out the window as we hibernate down, or otherwise called anhedonia is the fancy word. But that's because your brain doesn't want you to be expending any energy, going out and using it up on these frivolous, fun activities, and instead just hibernating down in bed. And that we don't do it to the extent of squirrels or bears, but we'll give it a fair go. So that's why we get that pleasure reduction as well as the energy reduction. You'll also notice reductions in curiosity, passion, interest, any of those emotions that would motivate you to go out and use up your valuable energy.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why I wanted to talk to myself about those things, remind myself of those things I enjoy, because actually when you're depressed, you might not even be able to think of those things. So the good thing about writing this letter is I was able to jot some things down, puzzles, anime, going to the dog park, spending time with Katie's one of my best friends, spending time with her was something that I knew would help me. So those kind of reminding myself of those and encouraging myself to do those things. And one of the big things that I wanted to touch on in this letter to myself about depression was about being kind to myself, because one of the big things, and I think you've noticed this with our clients as well, is that being mean to yourself, being quite self-negative, is a massive part of depression.
Yes, so you've got a feedback loop that can make that more likely. But also it can be the cause, in a way, in that the negative view of self can be the cause, because that can be the thing that we feel hopeless about. That negative future can be, I suck, right? Or no one could love me, right? Yeah. It could be a core belief that's negative about self, but that it's not going to be resolved, aka it's hopeless. And then we depress down to just wait for that to blow over, even though it obviously won't, because it feels like there's nothing we can do about it. So there's no point expending energy. So we save it.
Yeah, it's such a tricky downward spiral. And I want to point out one of the things I used to do when I was depressed was to try and motivate myself by being negative towards myself, like yelling horrible stuff at me to try and motivate myself to exercise. And when negative self fueling depression, that doesn't help. Just as a heads up, that really doesn't help. And so even though if you feel like that might motivate you, even if it does in the short term, it's really important not to use that, to instead focus on more positive forms of motivation, rewards, that sort of stuff, to help get you to do things.
Otherwise, you're just digging the hole deeper. If the hole is being negative on self and you'd be more negative on yourself, then shovel to the soil there.
Exactly. So that's something I wanted to cover with myself. And especially, I think that self-negativity can also come with a certain level of self-anger. I found I directed anger at myself when I was angry with someone who was too big or intimidating for me to feel like I could actually do something about that. And that might happen in your life if there's something external to you, a situation, a person. And it's really important not to turn that anger towards ourselves. Releasing that anger can be helpful. So like punching a pillow, throwing an egg at a fence. I remember when you were younger, you used to punch pillows.
Yeah, yeah. To get through being bullied period of my life. Absolutely. It was my mum's recommendation.
Yeah. Go Pauline. So yeah, throw an egg at the fence, drive in the car and scream. I've done that before, swearing in the car. That's a good way to get it out. And throwing my legs and arms and legs around. So that movement, getting that kind of releasing that would help. Also, I just wanted to reaffirm to myself that I was a good mum, because I thought it was very likely that I might be getting down because of negative thoughts about my parenting, especially because it was close to that whole maternity thing. And oh my gosh, the mum shame. The mum shame's real. Oh man, as mums, we're so hard on ourselves. And so it was really important for me to say some positive things about myself. And I know when we were coming up with the mental health plan, was one of those things that popped up, and I was just like, wow, I'm not caring for myself because I don't feel like I deserve it, because I don't think I'm a good mum. It's like, I need to nip that one in the bud. So that was one of the other things I wanted to cover off. And lastly, like, sometimes you can see in advance, like, quite a big thing that could be impacting on it. And COVID was something that I was like, it could be COVID. It could be COVID that I'm down about. And that's so massive. And for me, I've realized through this whole COVID situation that I can still survive and thrive despite what's going on in the world, even with all this COVID stuff. And so I wanted to remind myself of that and to be grateful for the things that are working out. It's amazing how even some of the negative stuff about COVID has had positives for me. So I wanted to just point that out to myself. And there might be some big thing that you can see that could be a part of why you might end up being depressed. And so speaking into that specific is quite important if you're writing a letter to yourself. And I just wanted to finish up with just letting myself know that it would pass. So that's the depression side of things. And I wanted to cover that in a lot more detail because that's actually the most likely thing that you're going to get after birth. It's the highest percentage of people struggle with depression over the other sort of conditions we're going to talk about.
Yep, that's why most people will have heard of postnatal depression.
Exactly. So it was something I prepared for the first time as well. And so it might be worth writing a letter to yourself for that if you are going into birth, because it is quite, that the possibility is higher for this. The other things that I am going to talk about, I'm going to cover in less detail. I'm not going to read out the letters because they're more specifically to me, but helpful to go over them. And just again, those, what I would cover in those letters about those conditions. If you hear little noises in the background, we're having to film this with our very new son. He was really settled before and he's not as settled now. So sorry about that. But this is parenting. The second one I covered actually was hyperactivation. Do you think you'd be able to like cover what that kind of is, Michael?
Yeah, so it was a term that we came up with that was less loaded and unhelpful than mania or hypomania, because Becky didn't really cover criteria for either of those. Even at the level of hypomania, you've still got grandiosity or intense irritability and some sort of spree, shopping sprees or trying to start a cult, that kind of thing. So hyperactivation seemed like a good non-loaded term to be able to use to describe the up, where mood, well, saying mood elevates makes it sound like you always feel positive, which can be the case, or people can be more irritable. It's more activated, more stimulated. You get less need for sleep. We talk more, that kind of thing. So Becky got really talky. It was hard to get a word in edgeways.
Oh, totally. No inhibitions. It was also kind of like being tipsy as well.
Yeah, yep,
was
yep,
one of the things. And
it.
So, yeah, just not really having a filter. So saying things that I wouldn't say normally.
And trying to get you to go to sleep. It's like, nope, don't need to sleep. I want to tidy.
Yeah, but then I would find it very hard to focus, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So that's what I had. And so in the letter, one of the big things that I wanted to cover was who to trust, because in the early stages, it wasn't so much of a problem. In the later stages, when trauma became a problem, trust was really difficult when I was in that up state and I was viewing other people quite negatively. And so I wanted to point out who were the people who I knew I could trust. And for me, that was Michael, this guy here. And also my therapist, Jane, was someone who I thought would be the person that I'd be able to trust. And then also I wanted to cover off that last time I might have lots of ideas and they might feel like really great ideas at the time. And they may be, like, some of them we have acted on from the last time I was up. They were actually were great ideas. Getting rid of the filter was actually good for like creative thinking. In the letter, I really talked to myself about sitting on those ideas, not acting on them right away, especially because I had a newborn at the time.
Yes. And the main issue, and also part of a reason why you, well, not so much wrote the letters, but created the plan, the mental health plan around the birth, was to give other people reassurance that right now, while writing the plan, you were in a completely sane state of mind, so that later on you could refer them back to that. Because even though the ideas were great, the way that you're presenting them because of being so up made it less believable for people.
Yeah.
And they got concerned.
Exactly. And when people get concerned, sometimes they do things. And this is where I really wanted to be able to talk to myself, to help myself through that when I maybe wasn't in a position to really be helping myself at that time. There was that sort of thing.
Yeah, just to say on there, going up after a birth, turns out the likelihood of that is around about 10% of people get that one, whereas I think postnatal depression is more around the 20-30% mark.
And it's good to also know that it will pass. So about 2 to 6 weeks for the up is something you can expect it not to just, it doesn't go on and on and on. Mm. Where depression can be quite a lot longer because it's slower.
Well, it's because of the maintenance cycles. Mm. So if there's a maintenance cycle going on, like self-negativity we mentioned earlier, then that can easily be maintained by talking quite negatively to self and beating self up and telling yourself not good enough and not a good parent and all of that. And so that can maintain that state of self-negativity, for example. Whereas what tends to kick off the hyperactivation in the research is the sleep deprivation or a disruption to circadian rhythms. And as that evened itself up, it eased away.
So definitely getting sleep really helped. And so I wanted to cover that off and also to work on the talking. For me, like I wanted to have a chat to myself about the talking and it felt like this need to say everything at the time. And it became this incessant talking where I would talk over people and I would not stop. I think one day I talked almost 21 hours straight. It was just insane.
Yep.
And so one of the things I did find helped for me with that was just like I wanted to tell myself I didn't have to say everything. that I could hold stuff back, that it wasn't a necessity for everyone to hear everything I had to say, and to really breathe through that, to take some deep breaths when I found myself incessantly talking. And also there was one other thing that came with the going up, was this feeling of shame afterwards. Because it's so much more intense, I feel like the hyperactivation is like an intensifying of emotion and all that sort of stuff. It also meant the things I did were more intense and more embarrassing than necessarily what I did with depression. With depression, it's that hibernation. I was withdrawing from people. The hyperactivation, wanting to go out. I was wanting to talk to everyone and tell everyone everything. And so there was kind of like a hangover afterwards of like, I can't believe I said and did that. And so I wanted in the letter to kind of cover off that it's okay, that if I was tipsy and I said some stupid things, then it's understandable and it doesn't mean that I'm a terrible person. The next one I went into was trauma. And this is a funny one, because if you've had trauma with a previous birth, it'd probably be a good idea to do this letter to yourself. And I really wanted to do it because I'd had the past trauma. And I think the first thing I really wanted to cover off is checking if the threat is real. And so I talked to myself in this letter about people who I can check with to see whether the thing I'm afraid of is actually going to happen or whether it's just something that is trauma. Because with trauma, it feels like the trauma is happening now. And so it can feel like that danger is imminent right now. And I wasn't sure whether I'd be able to pick up whether that was the case or not. And so I had to talk to Michael and my therapist about that. Also, because actually part of my trauma happened because I predicted a threat worse than was actually there. If I had actually had a chat to Michael about that, potentially I wouldn't have done the things that I did. And that ended up contributing to the trauma. So yeah, I think checking that it's real, and regardless of whether it's real or not, the threat, using grounding. We've got a worksheet that we're creating at the moment, which we'll try to add in the show notes, of our 5 top grounding techniques.
Grounding, for emotional regulation.
Yeah, emotional regulation, and it brings you into the present moment. That's the main thing, is like when you're triggered and you're, you know, hyperactivated and you just feel like that things happening right now and you're not really present to the moment, it brings you back and brings you back into the present moment. And that's why it's so powerful. The other thing that I really wanted to remind myself to do in the letter was tapping. But emotional freedom technique is something that we've got into recently.
EFT.
And I find it's actually really helpful for kind of maintenance type stuff. I really love EMDR for the kind of working through, especially small T trauma, the little traumas in life. Working through those and reprocessing what your thoughts about yourself, especially, I think, through those.
Well, it's so fast. That makes it pretty convenient to be able to do those.
EMDR is great. EMDR is more of a long-term thing and it takes a bit more time, whereas EFT is kind of like radical acceptance in the moment.
Well, I mean, it depends what you consider a long time with the EMDR. I mean, it's surprisingly fast when you've had a trauma for a while and you think that's it, you know, it's going to be lifelong. You can... Sometimes people will get through something in half a session, not always, but it can take many sessions, but it really depends. But that could be considered fast or it could be considered slow. It depends on your perspective.
Yeah, exactly. We did quite a lot of EMDR leading up to the birth of the past trauma, which was really helpful. But the tapping was really good, because you say, even if the terrible, horrible thing happens, I fully and utterly accept it. And then you do the tapping. And that sort of radical acceptance along with calming, it was really powerful. And I did use that after the birth. And so I wanted in the letter to encourage myself to do that. And as well as encouraging myself about my own agency. So this is a big thing with trauma. And there was that story.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, there were, is that in Australia? Maybe. Some people were trapped in a mine in an accident, and it took quite a while for them to be rescued, and some of them died. What was found in following them up for research afterwards was that everyone got affected by trauma except for one person, and that was the self-appointed leader of the group, who was saying about agency, had a sense of agency because they were helping organize everyone down there, so they felt like they were doing something. Helplessness is a big part of trauma. It's when we feel that there's nothing we can do that we tend to get traumatized.
Yeah. And something that we've been learning as part of actually a lot of our personal development is this sort of intense taking responsibility. It's like 100% responsibility for the situation. That might feel really hard, but it's actually quite empowering, because then it's like, okay, so I always have a choice, even if it's a selection of not great choices, just stepping out of that complete powerlessness and no choice in the matter can really help with that trauma. And this was one of the things that I worked through. And I wanted to give myself credit for the fact that I had more power than I often believe I have in situations. Especially looking back at my trauma, actually, I had a lot more power in that situation than I felt at the time. And as I worked through that, realizing my own power, that helped me move through the trauma actually as well. Yeah, leaning into that empowerment was something else I wanted to talk about in that letter. So that's what I covered off in a letter about trauma. And I think that's a good idea to, if you're going to write yourself a letter, if you've got trauma in the past and you're going into a situation which you think might be triggering of that trauma, to really speak into it could be really helpful for you. Because when you get triggered into trauma, you're not in your current more developed mind. You get sent back into wherever you were at that time in that fearful state. And so it's really good to be able to speak to yourself in that moment from a part of yourself that can help. The last one that I covered, so I did four letters to myself before the birth, and the last one I covered was suicidality. This isn't something I'd recommend for people to do if they are leading up to a birth, if they haven't been suicidal in the past, because it's not a huge risk factor when you're having a baby to get suicidal. There's a lot of protective factors when you've just had a baby. You're often, a lot of your instincts around, you know, protecting your baby and staying around and that sort of stuff. But what I found problematic actually after my first birth wasn't suicidality, it was people thinking I was suicidal when I actually wasn't. But this letter was just, basically, it was a bit of to cover off for other people more than necessarily myself. But it was also really interesting writing this letter. It was hard because you're having to go back into a mindset, if you're writing it having been suicidal before, you're having to go back and think about where you were at mentally when you were suicidal and think about what you could have said to yourself to bring yourself back down again. It was hard. And I think a lot of these letters were hard, but I think that was the hardest one for me to write. And because of how raw it is to get to that close to the edge. For me, when I was writing that letter, I firstly wanted to cover off something quite specific to myself, which was around panic. And I had this cycle going on where I would panic and then I would want to escape. And so I'd think about suicide. And then I'd freak out because I think I'm going to commit suicide. And then I'd panic more. And then my brain would think, want to escape from those overwhelming feelings. And then it would think about suicide. And it was this horrible cycle I'd get into. So that was something I wanted to talk about. There was things that I'd learned that really helped me with that. And so I wanted to remind myself of those, not to tell myself what to do as much as just as a reminder. But if there's something that specifically triggered off suicide for you in the past, suicidality for you in the past, then speaking into that, I think, is really helpful if you're going to write yourself a letter like this. The other thing I covered in that letter was actually to do with medication. So something I didn't realize when I first started taking medication is that it can have a side effect where you become suicidal, which I think is crazy, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah. If you look at adolescents especially, then it's not even that rare. I mean, you'd think that would be a pretty rare side effect, but it's around the 16% mark of teenagers that end up with that effect from SSRIs, modern antidepressants.
Yeah, and so for me, I wanted to remind myself of that and that to check if I'm on any medication that might be triggering that. And it might be medication to do with mental health, but it might be some other medication which has that side effect. Because all the times when I personally have been suicidal, it's had some form of link to either going onto a medication or coming off it. So that was something I wanted to just kind of check off with myself in my letter. Also, letting people know was another thing I wanted to cover. One of the most important things that has kept me here has been that I've opened up with people about it and got help. And so that's something, but there were safe people to do that with, like with Michael and my therapist. Also, like I personally wanted to cover about staying for the kids. And it's funny because I know when I was depressed and suicidal, the idea of sticking around from other people was quite anger-inducing actually, because I was like, I'm suffering, why do I need to stick around for you? When it comes to my kids though, there was this thing of kind of, it's about taking the pressure off as well. It's not you have to stick around and be the perfect parent. It's you just, me just being there, being a mum, being alive is way better than me not being there. It's interesting, actually, one of the things that's been really, I think, almost preventative in terms of suicidality for me recently. Not that I have been suicidal, but has just made me want to be alive even the more so. It's been writing wills, which is so funny because you have to go through all the details of...
And think of all the scenarios.
All the scenarios of what happens if you pass away and who gets what and if they don't get it, who did... And you just realize how complicated it is when someone passes and that actually people aren't better off. It's hard. Aside from all the grief, just the complication of someone passing is massive. Yeah. And so I...
Well, you just mentioned something quite interesting in that you were saying earlier that you'd been annoyed because you were like, oh, well, why do I have to stick around for you? But often, and you found this at points as well back in the day, is that generally... People think that the best advice to give someone who's suicidal is like, oh, but, you know, think about the people and think how selfish you're being and that kind of thing. But generally it is so negative on self that's caused them to reach that point that they're going, people would be better off without me around. That's often what's motivating it, and that it is for other people. They're thinking they're being selfless by thinking about ending things and no longer being a bother to people. So like Becky's saying, thinking about people who are actually going to be better off and writing that in a letter in advance so that you're in that headspace that can see that, and pinning it to yourself so that you can read that later can be quite helpful.
Yeah, and that was for me, and just pointing that out. And also that I think part of that is not wanting to stick around because I felt like life was just suffering and that it was never going to get any better. And one of the things I found was after being suicidal a number of years later, I had some of the best years of my life, you know, just really loving life with what we do now, finding purpose.
Well, you were with me.
Well, I think we've grown together a lot, and we actually doing the business, what we do together has been a huge life purpose and joy for me. Mm. What we do helping people has been awesome. And so I just reminded myself that this will pass and that things can be better than they are right now. And they have done that in the past, so why not again? And lastly, one of the things I covered in this letter around suicidality for myself was about options. One of the problems with suicidality is as much a problem of not being able to problem solve well and thinking that the only solution is for you to pass away. It's actually a really rubbish solution because there's so many other options that if you go, okay, well, that's on the table, what else could we do? Actually, a million other options will come up that are actually better than that final solution. And so I just wanted to remind myself of that. And that's actually something that I got from Michael because it's one of your protective factors.
Yeah, it just automatically has popped up in the past when that's ever flashed to mind. It's like, well, okay, well, like Becky said, if that's on the table, then, well, okay, we've got just like disappearing overseas, you know, spending every last bit of my savings to have some fun, or like quit my job, or like go join a cult, I don't know. It opens up like a whole bunch of crazy options. You'd be like, oh, I wouldn't dare, or that might be so shameful, or like, oh, I'd feel really bad about my future then or something. But you can go ahead and explore some crazy options, and then it frees up the mind to then go, oh, okay, well, actually, like, there are a whole bunch of options and I could make my life better from whatever is causing me to view it so intensely, hopelessly.
And sometimes you do get into a situation where all the options just feel pretty rubbish. And at that point, what I've found actually is just taking one of the rubbish options and going with it. Often, like, moving, continuing forward, it's amazing how then other options will come into your path that are better later on. But so I wanted to cover that off for myself. And through all of these letters, it was really hard to sit down and write them because I had to envision myself being back in that place, which I didn't want to do. And so I did feel a lot of resistance. But interestingly, I think there was a large amount of prevention just from actually writing them. Can you think of why that might be?
Yeah, you're essentially doing in advance, challenging those very thoughts that might come up.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah. So I'm challenging those thoughts. I'm challenging what's underlying them and putting forward an alternative. I'm actually doing the thing of talking myself through it before it even happens. And what I found was that I did struggle a little bit after the birth this time round. I did go up a bit. With that hyperactivation, I had even had a little bit of low mood around straight afterwards, especially because there were some difficulties with his birth and some misinterpretations of what happened that I felt kind of numb about. But
with all the preparation that I did, I was able to go through this so much better than the last time. And I'm really grateful that I did the hard work of actually thinking to write these letters to myself, I didn't actually even need to read them, but I think just the process of creating them was a big help. And this, these letters are just part of the mental health plan that we did, which was something that I decided that I really wanted to have so that I could be more empowered. And this is the thing, the challenge with mental health is that when you're in that situation, people don't always listen to what you want. Sometimes you don't even quite know what you want, and what you're wanting is different, but not being able to make those choices when you're in your right mind and then having everyone supporting that, those, that's what's going to happen. Being able to outline what your non-negotiables are around your mental health care before it actually happens was really empowering for me. And to go into it knowing that my parents, in-laws, my husband, my therapist, all were on the same page and supporting me was just one of the most powerful things I've done. And so I'd really recommend, if you're going into birth, mental health after birth can be a struggle. And there are people who get depressed, some people go up, and sometimes there can be trauma. And so having a plan in place for what you can do can really help you to get through that more smoothly. And so we've created a plan that is, you can fill out, so you can personalize it to yourself, covering a range of different possible struggles, including what we've covered today. And you can fill it out for yourself, create that plan, share it with your loved ones and your support people so that you can get through your birth and enjoy it. You can find those in the show notes. We'll have a link to go download that. And so you can get started on preparing for positive mental well-being after birth. Thanks for joining us for this podcast. I'm Becky Burrows.
And I'm Michael Burrows.
And we are here to help you to live a life free from the controls of anxiety. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Anxiety Specialist podcast. That's it for this week's episode. If you found this episode helpful, make sure to click the follow button and please do share this with your family and friends. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook or Instagram. That's at Anxiety Specialists. And if you're interested to learn how you can live an anxiety-free life, you can get our epic Anxiety Reducer Guide absolutely free, so you can get started right away on getting your anxiety back down. Just grab the link in the show notes. Feel free to message us and let us know what you'd like to learn next. I am your host, Michael Burrows.
And I'm Becky Burrows.
And we're going to be back next week with more tips, strategies, and insights so you can get the anxiety-free life you deserve.